Hey everybody, it's Kadra. At the time that you are listening to this, I am recovering from several days of travel. I took a girls' trip, a bachelorette, to Miami, and I have been extremely busy, but I wanted to make sure that you guys had something in your ears. So not too long ago, I did a collab with one of my dear friends, Alicia, from the Truly Twisted podcast. So over on her show, she told me the story of the Black Dahlia. So that is what you guys are going to hear today. There is a lot of back and forth, a lot of commentary, so I thought it would be good for you guys to hear. And I also would love if you guys give Alicia a follow. She does amazing work over on Truly Twisted. She releases new episodes every week. The episodes are victim focused. It is ethically consumed true crime, and she does a great job with her research and everything. I've known Alicia a very long time. And she and I will also be at CrimeCon together at the end of May in Vegas. So if any of you guys are natives to that area or you're going to be at CrimeCon, Alicia and I would love to meet you. So I hope you enjoy this episode of The Black Dahlia and go give Truly Twisted a follow.
On the morning of January 15th, 1947, Betty Bursinger, a young mother, was taking her three-year-old daughter for a walk in Leimert Park. This was a neighborhood of Los Angeles previously used to house World War II veterans, but as the war had winded down, many of these lots became empty, and unfortunately, people would dump their garbage there all the time. As they were walking, Betty noticed a pale limb in the grass by the sidewalk, and initially she believed it to be a discarded mannequin. But tragically, it was the body of 22-year-old Elizabeth Short, posed grotesquely in the grass. There had been no attempt to hide her. But to this day, this is one of the biggest mysteries in true crime history, and we still do not know who her killer is. So let's talk about it today. Hello and welcome to another episode of Truly Twisted. As always, I'm your host, Alicia Watson, and every Thursday I will be bringing you a story that is always victim-focused and fact-based. Today, I have one of my best friends and fellow podcasters joining me to weigh in on one of the most famous cases in true crime history. This story is perplexing, to say the least, which made Kadra of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast, the perfect person to discuss it with. Hello, Kadra. Welcome.
Hello, Alicia. Thank you so much for having me. I am super excited to get into this. I don't know if iconic's the best word, but it really is an iconic true crime case. And I haven't heard the story in a while, so it'll be good to refresh my memory and be able to actually discuss it with someone.
Yes, I think it's one of those ones that you need to have somebody discuss it with.
Yeah.
But before we get into the story, do you want to tell my listeners a little bit about yourself and where they can find you and your show?
Sure, I would love to. So I host Perplexity, a mystery podcast, new episodes every Wednesday, and it's all things mysterious. So the way I always tell it to people is if you like unsolved mysteries, it's a similar vibe. There is some episodes that take more of a comedy element, but for the most part, it's more of a serious tone like this show. A lot of research, fact-based, and I cover a lot of true crime as well. So always happy to have you guys. You can check me out anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm also on YouTube, Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast.
Yes, and Kadra is a big part in what you may be seeing today, as I've now started a YouTube channel as well. So thank you for being my little YouTube guinea pig and creating a space where I feel brave enough to actually post it on the internet.
Absolutely. I'm excited for you. YouTube has a lot of benefits, and it's a very effective way to get these important stories out to more people.
Agreed. So follow us both on YouTube, guys. And if you like the show, which we know you do, You will love Kadra, so definitely go and check her out. All of the information will be in the show notes. So I like to tell stories in chronological order, but I also want to honor Elizabeth Short because her life was taken way too soon and in the most horrific and torturous way. So I will be using her name throughout, but this case is famously known as the Black Dahlia because for a long time they actually didn't know her identity. So even though in the beginning pieces of the story they don't know who she is, I am going to use her name though.
Okay.
Rather than a Jane Doe, the Black Dahlia was a nickname given by the media, likely inspired by the horror film The Blue Dahlia that came out in 1946, referencing the Jane Doe's dark hair and the lurid nature in which her murder had taken place. She was also known, allegedly, once her identity came about, to have worn black clothing quite frequently, which solidified the nickname.
Gotcha. That's always such That's always such a controversial thing in true crime cases is like, should we or shouldn't we give this iconic kind of name to a case or to a serial killer? And there's definitely times that it's very sensationalized and ridiculous, but at the same time, it does help you remember the case.
And it is infamous and it was meant to attract readers, and the nickname certainly stuck. So on the morning of January 15th, 1947, like I said, Betty Bersinger, a young mother, was taking her three-year-old child for a walk. This neighborhood in Los Angeles at the time had lots of empty lots where people are going to people and dump empty garbage and all sorts of stuff because they didn't want to pay to take it to a landfill. And it was a little bit overgrown, but it was still level enough that you could see through the lots. So as they were walking, she saw a pale limb in the grass by the sidewalk of what she initially believed to be a discarded mannequin. And as we know, Kadra, it's never a mannequin. As they got closer, Betty quickly realized that this was the body of a young woman and quickly ushered her child past before calling 911. What they saw was a cleanly severed body of 22-year-old Elizabeth Short, posed grotesquely, and there was no attempt to hide her. The location likely was chosen for a reason. The empty block in the early morning hours would have allowed the killer privacy to lay her body out, but by the time that the sun came up, the sidewalk guaranteed an audience with maximum shock value. Ugh. Whoever did this wanted the world to see it.
I mean, that makes sense with them posing her, like, yeah, I mean, it seems like they're very clearly trying to send some kind of message with location and posing.
Mm-hmm. Her body was cleanly cut in half at the waist, and pieces of her flesh were cut away from her body. And while she was severely mutilated, there was no blood anywhere, suggesting that the body had been thoroughly cleaned before being positioned in that spot. Her face had been mutilated with what became known as the Glasgow smile carved into her mouth. Think the Joker, but way deeper.
Oh my God.
The autopsy photos are available online, and from the side, it actually looks like she's missing part of her jaw. The cuts were so deep from ear to ear. And sadly, these were found to be done before she actually died and was related to her cause of death, which I will get into. So Elizabeth suffered. But let's talk about her for a moment. She was born on July 29th, 1924, and was one of five daughters born to her parents, Cleo and Phoebe, in Boston, Massachusetts. Cleo worked building miniature golf courses until the 1929 stock market crash, and the family sadly lost all of their savings.
Oh, that's awful.
In 1930, his car was found abandoned on the Charleston Bridge, and it was presumed that he had completed suicide, although his body was never found.
This is the father?
Yes.
Wow.
In order to provide for the family, Phoebe began working as a bookkeeper, and when Elizabeth was 15, she underwent lung surgery. She had suffered frequently from bronchitis and severe asthma attacks, which, girl, I can relate. And the doctor suggested that the family move to a milder climate to help with her breathing, which makes sense. I myself find when I'm somewhere warmer, I breathe beautifully. So.
Okay. Yeah. And you said they were in You say Massachusetts?
Yes. So Got we know it, yeah. colder climate in the winters.
Right. Gets really cold there.
Okay. Definitely a wetter climate for sure.
So is this when they would go into California?
No, actually. Elizabeth spent winters with her family friends in Miami, Florida for the next 3 years.
Oh.
Unfortunately, okay. being a single mother of five, their family couldn't afford to relocate. So this was a solution that Phoebe had come up with in order to help her daughter, you know, kind of heal and thrive when it wasn't the best condition for her and still sense. Have her be able to be a part of the family. So,
yeah, that makes sense. There's actually a decent amount of true crime cases that I've covered where things like this come up, where the parent is struggling, going through like a really hard time. And it's hard to imagine having to like give your child away essentially to someone else. But I have heard that quite a bit of like just wanting them to be safe and in a better situation. So they'll
yeah,
they'll
sometimes thriving is better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can imagine it would have been hard though.
Absolutely. But you said she would still go visit them?
Yes. So she would go there for just like the winters and then she would come back home.
Gotcha. Okay.
In late 1942, Phoebe Short received a letter from Cleo, of whom the family had originally thought was dead for the last 12 years, so the father.
Whoa.
He wrote an apology letter stating that he had started a new life in California.
Shut up.
So he faked his own death and ran away from his family. Rude.
Whoa. That is like such an, that is like my worst nightmare. I mean, that you hear things like that in every true crime case as a theory of like if it's a disappearance, oh, they wouldn't yes. started a new life. And you're always like, oh, that's ridiculous. This guy actually did that.
And I get it. The familial pressures that men experienced back then. And if you lost all your money, you know, like that's one of the biggest causes of like family annihilators. Like usually mm-hmm. it's something financially related that takes place. So I guess
right.
this is the lesser of two evils, but it still had to have been devastating for this family, especially Phoebe. Right.
Yeah, I'm still, you know, just a believer in transparency, just communication.
Good old fashioned communication. And if Phoebe Funny. Managed to make this happen for the next 12 years, he could have been a part of it. I'm just saying.
Right. Wow.
So Elizabeth dropped out of high school, and instead of going to Florida that next December, she decided to go to California and relocated to Vallejo to live with her father. Though that reunion was short-lived, as they argued often, leaving Elizabeth to move out in early 1943. So this is how she ended up in California.
I mean, yeah, there has to be a lot of unresolved trauma from what he did to his family.
And also like respect on her part for willing, like wanting to give him a chance and go and mm-hmm. see him.
Right. Yeah. Cause he didn't deserve it.
Agreed.
Mm.
So Elizabeth was just 18 at this point, and she took a job as a desk clerk at Camp Cook and moved in with a presumably kind army sergeant for a period of time that was willing to take her in. Although he quickly became abusive towards her, and that gesture of taking her in wore off. We Damn. Don't know much about Elizabeth in terms of personality, but given her life up to this point, we know that she was resilient. So she moved out yet again.
Yeah, women do be resilient.
Now mid-1943, Elizabeth moved to Santa Barbara, but she was arrested for underage drinking on September 23rd at a local dive bar. So, you know, she was 18, so she's technically an adult, but juvenile authorities ordered that it would be likely better for her to just go back to Massachusetts and be with her mother instead of, you know, serving prison any jail time for this misdemeanor, essentially.
I gotcha. Okay,
they're like, okay. you know, maybe you're not ready to be on your own out here. Maybe go back home to your mom. But instead, she went to the family friends in Florida instead.
Okay.
I get it. She likes the warmth. But she yeah. did visit her family and mother in Boston often.
Well, and I mean, it sounds like she spent a lot more time in Florida. I mean, she would still go visit her biological family and like the seasonally. So, but I mean, this was probably honestly maybe I don't want to speculate, but it sounds like she might have been closer with the people in Florida.
Yeah, and just like a better situation for her. I mean, yeah. also, she's probably thinking she's going to go home to Boston and get in a lot of trouble. So,
Makes sense.
That would be my guess if I had been arrested.
Yeah.
But while living in Florida, Elizabeth met an Army Air Force officer named Matthew Michael Gordon Jr. And the two fell in love. They had this like typical romance of the 1940s. Elizabeth stated that he had proposed marriage in a letter while he was recovering from a plane crash injury in India. So she had received this letter from India.
Jeez.
And she had allegedly accepted the marriage proposal, but tragically, he died during a second crash on August 10th, 1945.
Oh, come on.
So the two never got to be together.
Yeah, this poor girl can't catch a break. That's horrible. So I'm assuming he flew planes then for the Army. He was a pilot?
I'm guessing so. Yeah.
Okay, because to not be a pilot and be in two plane crashes, like, yeah, you're in the military, but that's still, that would be very, very unlucky. Man, I feel so bad for her.
Yeah. In July of 1946, Elizabeth went back to California to Los Angeles to visit an old Air Army Force friend named Joseph Fickling, who was stationed in Long Beach. Elizabeth had gotten a job serving and rented a room behind the Florentine Gardens nightclub on Hollywood Boulevard.
Mm.
According to some people who knew her, Elizabeth opted to stay in California in hopes of becoming a film star. She definitely had the look, fair complexion, dark hair, green eyes. She was stunning.
Mm.
But tragically, she never got that opportunity before her murder. On January 9th, 1947, Elizabeth came home after a brief trip to San Diego to visit a man that she was allegedly having an affair with named Robert Manley. And I should say, he was the one having an affair.
Wait, did she get married? Did I miss something?
No, no. He was married. Yeah.
Okay. Man.
And according to Robert, he dropped Elizabeth off at the Biltmore Hotel in downtown Los Angeles, where she was going to be meeting with one of her sisters visiting from Boston.
And where did he live?
He lived in San Diego, California.
Okay, so that's like a couple hours from Long Beach.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
So they made the drive back. He dropped her off. And some of the Biltmore employees said that they saw Elizabeth using the lobby telephone. And then she was seen later that same evening at the Crown Grill Cocktail Lounge down the street from the Biltmore.
Okay, and no one saw her with a man?
No. No one saw her with anybody or, like, confirmed that she was with her sister or, like, they just said that they saw her. No one's for certain who she was with.
Got it.
That is where Elizabeth's known actions end. Sometime between January 9th and January 15th, Elizabeth would experience the unthinkable, bringing us to this horrific discovery of her body on January 15th.
Oh, wow. Okay, so that's so like 6 days. That's a really big gap.
Yeah. They call it like the missing week. Like they actually, for days, like police bulletins went up everywhere trying to find any information of like any more movements, because from the time that her body was found and completely drained of blood and posed there, that would have taken enough time to believe that she was at least dead up to 10 hours prior to her body being discovered, which would be the 14th. So sometime in those 5 days, she was taken by somebody.
Wow. Yeah. And that's kind of surprising that, I mean, at this point in the story, at least, that there's not really any eyewitness testimony for 6 days, because this sounds like a really busy area and she is a very memorable looking person, you know.
And she had a lot of friends. Like, she was known to be very social and like frequent cocktail lounges and have she loved to have fun. She was a young 22-year-old girl living in downtown LA. Of course she wanted to. So it's just like, how did nobody connect with her in that time period? Which leads me to believe that she was taken closer to the 9th.
Yeah, well, and that's what I was going to say, is like at the same time, there very well could have been a situation where she was kidnapped or lured somewhere and then like held there, and she very clearly was like very slowly and methodically tortured in a horrific manner and then cleaned, indicating she was killed at a different location. So I mean, it's possible she was held somewhere for days, which could make sense with nobody seeing her.
Yeah, but you don't want to believe that because that's even more horrific than what she's already experienced.
Of course, right.
So get ready to be a little bit mad here because I don't think investigators did a great job with this case.
Shocker.
The LAPD is historically problematic, so.
Yes, yes. Sorry, as someone who has covered true crime for the last several years, I have heard way too many stories where law enforcement didn't secure a scene properly. And like, yes, I know that we're in the 40s, but still.
It's incredibly upsetting, especially with, like, they actually, during my research, I didn't include this in my notes, but the LAPD actually underwent a trial, I believe, in the early 1950s that they were scrutinized in a jury. Like, by a jury, in their inability to solve certain cases against women and children within, like, a 10-year period. Like, they had so many unsolved cases that they were under trial. And wow. Elizabeth's case came up in that list. But I'm just like, do better.
I've heard of things like that before, like, in other cases I've covered. And it's always so disheartening because these are the people that you're calling and expect to do their jobs and protect you. And don't get me wrong, there are people who absolutely do, but in the cases where they don't, it's really hard to get over that, you know?
Right. And in working with families, it's like you see how often their own resources are the ones being used to investigate their missing loved one. Not even just in California, like in all states. In all countries, it feels like, in some cases. So it's just
And this is also, this is not a small town. This is not a place where you're going to be running into like, oh, well, there's very limited resources here.
No, had the resources.
They would have plenty of resources in LA. And I bet the crime rates were high there too. So yeah, that's disappointing.
Wild. So reporters showed up to the scene before detectives did, and nothing was properly taped off or protected. It was an absolute shit show of an investigation, if we're being honest. So apparently there was a heel print and tire tracks found near Elizabeth's body and a quote unquote cement sack containing watery blood.
Whoa.
Don't cement, overthink that too much like I did, because initially I was like, what the f-? And cement then I realized sack? The cement sack, like the sack, those like paper bags that have like lined.
Oh.
Like a lined wrapper in it that carry cement before you get it wet.
Yeah. That's what it okay.
was. Like a paper sack, kind of. I read that as a cement sack and I'm like, huh?
No, that threw me off because that's not really a sentence you hear often, that phrasing. But okay. I mean,
that is how it was reported. Yeah. So that is how I'm presenting it. It was unclear whether or not that blood was tested and believed to have belonged to Elizabeth either, but presumably so. Like, I think that when the killer got there, he had some extra cleaning to do after moving her body a little bit more and wiping her down. And that's what was like watery blood is my thought process to that. Because otherwise, why is that there?
And I know that we had very limited forensic stuff back then, but you said they did not test the blood?
No, but presumably it did belong to Elizabeth. Part of the shit show that is this investigation.
Right. You have to be thorough and stuff like this. You have to be sure.
It was identified in several articles that photographs were taken of like these, the footprint and the tire tracks and stuff as well. But those photos don't exist anywhere, which leaves more people to believe than not that that was never photographed on scene.
Oh, interesting. Well, and that you said the media also got there before the police did. So who's to say that that heel print and tire track is from the killer?
Exactly.
Yeah.
An autopsy of Elizabeth's body was done the next day, noting ligature marks on her ankles, wrists, and neck, and an irregular laceration on her right breast. She also had lacerations on her forearms and the lower left side of her chest. Her body had been cleanly cut in a technique called a hemicorporectomy, and it was developed in the 1930s as an effort to remove all lower organs and genitalia and basically reroute the spinal cord so that people that were, for example, severed in the war could still live depending on the extent of their injuries.
Oh, my God.
I know.
That's horrific.
It is horrific.
And
like
okay,
her organs were like her bowel, like her intestines and stuff were like tucked under her buttocks. So it wasn't like properly done, but that was believed to have been the technique that this person was trying to do.
Well, first of all, so you said they did it in such a way where she would still be alive.
Yes. That so the person, but she was cut post-mortem. We do know that.
Interesting.
The cuts on her body, the way that like flesh is cut after somebody dies,
right,
looks different than when they're alive. Yeah. So they believe that all of these like torturous cuts on her body had happened while she was still alive. But her torso being cut from her legs happened after she had died.
But it being so cleanly cut like that, I mean, that makes me think that this person worked in the medical field somehow, or like mortician, or I mean,
yeah,
there's clues here with this.
For sure. That's like the biggest, one of the biggest pieces of evidence.
And then the ligatures, did they, and again, I know time period, I don't know how much they would know about this, but has anyone ever, because they took pictures too, I'm assuming, have they ever looked at the ligatures to see like how old they looked, like how long it looked like she
had been tied up? Like the bruising on her?
Yeah, like if it was like days old,
there was
for
no report on like how long it believed that, they just know that she had been restrained in some way.
Huh. That would be helpful because bruising, like though, stages, yeah, like different stages of bruising. So
some of the bruising though did indicate that she was basically strung up post-mortem, and that was a way of like draining her of her blood as well.
God.
But she was
like
initially
animal.
Restrained, so she had two sets of bruises.
Like a
freaking it's horrible.
Animal.
Yeah, like an animal. Yeah.
That is so sick. Wow. Well, and so that also makes me think that this person would have had to have had a very specific kind of structure to do this in. I mean, to string someone up, to drain them of their blood, you're not doing this in like an apartment complex, you
Correct.
Know? Hmm. Wow.
And Kadra took the words right out of my notes. This person that killed Elizabeth, or at least helped in the cover up, had to have some sort of medical knowledge.
Yeah. Well, and I would also think like access to some kind of warehouse or abandoned building, something with
exactly.
Drain. Wow.
Yeah.
Or a very remote location outdoors.
Yeah, for sure. She had lacerations and bruising on the side of her face and head, suggesting that she had been hit multiple times. And her official cause of death is listed as hemorrhaging from the lacerations to her face and the shock from the blows to her head and face.
Whoa. Okay.
So that, like, that was the final blow for her, and that's horrible.
And so are they thinking, like, a weapon was used to hit her face then and not, like, fists?
Yes. It was a blunt force. It was listed as a blunt force object. Like, I can't even imagine the pain and terror in her last moments of her life. And then, like I said earlier, the severing of her body had happened post-mortem, thankfully. And her body had also been cleaned, leaving behind no trace of the person responsible, which is my theory of what this weird watery bag of blood was.
Well, another thing with that, too, is with her getting the hemicorporectomy. Is that how you say it? Hemicorporectomy. So with her getting that, that would also, and again, time period, but that would erase any signs of sexual assault. So, like, with the crime being how it is, that does seem like it could have been very sexual in nature, but we don't know because
yes.
She was cut away.
Mm-hmm. Her anal cavity was slightly dilated, according to her autopsy report, which investigators thought that maybe that could have meant she was sodomized.
God, poor woman. This is horrible. Really, girl. I mean, she was so young.
22, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So Elizabeth was then identified by her fingerprints being in the system from her 1943 underage drinking arrest. A journalist had initially contacted Phoebe Short to ask some questions about her daughter, stating that Elizabeth had won a beauty contest. And then after several follow-up questions, the reporter was like, "What do I do?" And then told her that, "No, your daughter has actually been murdered." Phoebe didn't believe it until she had received confirmation from the Los Angeles Police Department. But that is horrible, and those reporters should be f***ing ashamed.
Okay, I was about to say, can I say the F word on this show?
Yes, because on this, that... guests are allowed to swear.
Okay, I'm sorry. I feel like this is an appropriate time. I know sometimes people get upset about cursing, but that is so f***ed up. Are you kidding? That is disgusting. That is the part of media that I hate. And this is a time in California, because I remember I covered the Chateau Marmont. This is a time in California where the paparazzis were... And I mean, they're still terrible now, but just absolutely ruthless, saying and doing the most horrific things to get a rise, get a reaction out of people, get the first story, blah, blah, blah. To trick the mom of this woman like that. Oh, she won a beauty contest. Da, da, da. Oh, actually, she was murdered. Hearing that over the phone as well from a complete stranger. You have totally ruined this woman's life.
100%. Like, it's disgusting behavior like that, and like people that falsely confess to crimes or like contact families and like torment them afterwards. Like, these are all among the worst people in existence, in my opinion.
Wow.
So 3 days later, a manila envelope arrived addressed to the Los Angeles Examiner and other Los Angeles papers with the words cut carefully from newspapers. The envelope contained Elizabeth's birth certificate, business cards, photographs with names written on pieces of paper, and an address book with the name Mark Hansen embossed on the cover. The packet had been carefully cleaned with gasoline, but despite the sender's efforts, several partial fingerprints were lifted from the envelope and sent to the FBI for testing. However, the prints were compromised in transit and could never properly be analyzed. Another fuck up in this investigation.
Are you kidding?
Yeah. I wish I was.
Wow. Sorry. That's extremely enraging. But I'm also wondering about the Mark Hansen thing. They were taken to the FBI for analysis. I'm wondering if it was like the LAPD was delivering it, or like, I'm wondering who messed that up. But
yeah.
Wow.
Police created a public notice asking for any information or sightings of Elizabeth between January 9th, like I told you earlier. But like we are thinking, I think she was held somewhere for a period of time, because there's no way that nobody would have seen or heard from her in that time period. That same day, a black suede shoe and a handbag were found in an alley garbage about 6 miles away from the crime scene. They, too, had been carefully cleaned, leaving behind no fingerprints. And Mark Hansen, the owner of the address book, was found and interviewed and admitted to being a friend of Elizabeth's. He had stated that on several instances that he had tried to take her on a date or be more than a friend, in which she had rejected his advances, leaving investigators to think that that was a motive for possible murder.
Sure.
But he was cleared of any involvement after interviews with police and a concrete alibi. But he did positively identify the shoe and the handbag as belonging to Elizabeth and being among the items that she was last seen wearing when she was spotted in the Biltmore Hotel. So,
sorry, are we not shocked that a man was able to identify that a handbag and shoes belonged to Elizabeth?
A woman? I know. I am a little shocked by that as well.
Like, never in my life, anyone I've ever dated, would they remember what I was like. I always think about that. If I like disappeared and the police were like, what was she wearing? They wouldn't remember.
Or like, if they were like, did this belong to Kadra? He'd be like, probably.
Yeah.
He had a lot of bags.
Wow. So he must have really been obsessed to seriously to like be able to identify.
Mitten.
Okay. I'm still very sus of him. But do we know what the concrete alibi was?
No, it didn't. That's all the articles just said.
See, that's the thing, though, is I feel like sometimes cops are just like, it's airtight. There's no way. And I'm like, okay, but like,
But people lie all the time for alibis. People's own mothers will be like, oh, no, they were with me all night when they killed somebody. Like,
100%. Yeah. So I want to know how corroborated this actually was, because this is the 40s. It's not like we have security footage putting him.
Yeah, there's no CCTV. Yeah.
No. Okay.
On January 26th, another letter was received by the Examiner, this time handwritten, and it read, here it is, turning in Wednesday, January 29th, 10 a.m. Had my fun at police. Black Dahlia Adventure. End quote. The letter also named the location in which the killer was allegedly supposed to turn himself in. Police waited at the location on January 29th in the morning, but the alleged killer never appeared. Instead, at 1 p.m., the examiner offices received another cut-and-paste style letter which read, quote, "I have changed my mind. You would not give me a square dealer. A square deal. Dahlia killing was justified," end quote.
No, it actually wasn't justified. And also, this is like giving Zodiac.
Put a pin in that thought.
Okay, what a loser.
Elizabeth's murder became a media sensation with all sorts of rumors circulating about who she was and how she lived her life. Several false confessions were made to police, and they underwent many hoax calls.
God.
Still, though, the popularity of the case only put more pressure on police to solve her murder.
I bet. Good.
750 investigators from the LAPD and other departments were assigned in various stages of Elizabeth's investigation. But to this day, her killer remains unknown.
Wow. I don't know if I've ever heard of a case that involved that many members
right?
of law enforcement. Yeah, wow. Do you know how long they looked at it for before they were like, okay, we can't do anything else?
Well, by February of 1947, they were stating that they had hit a wall, like that same year.
Okay.
Like within a month, they were like, we have no leads. Like none.
Okay.
After interviewing the two men that, you know, Robert, who had dropped her off at the Biltmore mm-hmm. Hotel, and Mark, who was presumably her friend and she had his address book, there was no other leads. That February, the LAPD admitted this and they issued a warrant to the University of the Southern California Medical School, which was the closest to where Elizabeth had been discovered, requesting a list of the program's students, and background checks were conducted as well as some interviews taking place. But the police were no closer to finding their killer. But that was the biggest piece of evidence, is that whoever had done this had medical knowledge in some way.
Right. So it makes sense because it's so close by. They're like, okay, let's look at people who work here and like students.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Now, Kadra and I could be here for an entire second episode talking yeah. about the false confessions and possible connections created over the years to other killers. But I am just going to talk about the top theories as they stand today. But as always, I want to know your guys' opinions too, so please feel free to send me a message on social media, comment on the poster episode, or email me at itstrulytwisted@gmail.com. So the first suspect was Norman Chandler. He was the publisher for the Los Angeles Times between 1945 and 1960. In Donald Wolfe's book, The Black Dahlia Files, The Mob, The Mogul, and The Murder That Transfixed Los Angeles, he claims that Norman had gotten Elizabeth pregnant and hired a gangster named Bugsy Siegel to kill her. Donald Wolfe contends that this theory is possible, as powerful people regularly bribed the corrupt LAPD to cover up their crimes. And I mean, yes, that's true, but this theory doesn't hold as much weight to me because there is no evidence that Elizabeth and Norman had a sexual relationship or knew each other at all.
Okay,
that, yeah. Elizabeth Short's murder made it impossible to tell whether or not she had ever been pregnant at the time of her death.
Okay, so that's what I was wondering is, like, how do we even know these people know each other? So this is just, like, speculation.
There's no tie. There was no, like, links that were ever found to the two of them. But that doesn't mean that they didn't meet up in secret, but also I'm not going to say stuff that's not true and I don't know. So
right. Or yeah, at the very least, like there's nothing to corroborate this.
Correct.
So, yeah. But it is a theory, so it's good to talk about it, but it doesn't have weight.
Correct. The next is Dr. George Hodel, a prominent Los Angeles surgeon. After retiring from the LAPD, a former police detective named Steve Hodel published a true crime book called Black Dahlia Murder, A Genius for Murder. In it, he outlines many of the details of the investigation and presents his own theory. He believes that his own father, Dr. George Hodel, killed Elizabeth Short.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. As soon as you said Steve Hodel, I was like, wait, so what's the relationship?
Yeah, so his own son believes that his father could be capable of doing this and possibly was involved. And in addition to Steve Hodel's theory, it was revealed that he had wiretapped his dad's home and obtained a recorded conversation with him and an unidentified visitor saying, "Supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia, they couldn't prove it now. They can't talk to my secretary because she's dead. They thought that there might be something fishy. Anyway, now they may have figured it out, killed her. Maybe I did kill my secretary," end quote. Okay, what? So now you've possibly killed two people?
Yeah, what? Have we checked on this secretary? What the hell?
If they or did, is, I don't or know.
Or is he just being sarcastic? Like, that's so ridiculous. That's like saying I killed my secretary. Do you know
Correct.
What I mean?
He could have been being facetious.
Tone makes a big difference. Like, I
Absolutely,
would like to hear that.
Wow, but that is allegedly a direct quote from the book. But again, before interviews could take place after this came out, he did pass away of cancer.
Huh. Yeah, I'm still not convinced about him. I mean, context is really, really important, and we don't really have anything on him. I wouldn't even say we have circumstantial. It's literally like a rumor at this point. Again, read the book. I don't know, but...
Additional damning evidence in the book is apparently one of George's daughters named Tamar accused him when she was 14 of sexually molesting her. And despite three witnesses testifying against the abuse, he was acquitted of that crime in December of 1949.
That's unfortunately not surprising.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
Yeah, it is horrible. This prominent doctor did this to his kid and he gets off for it? Like, no.
Yeah, I mean, sex crimes. Even now, we have a hard time getting anyone to take them seriously, but especially back then, and him being a prominent doctor.
And white men.
They probably were like, she's crazy. She made it up. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, that proves he's a piece of shit, but that doesn't prove that he's a murderer.
Or that he ever even knew Elizabeth.
Yeah.
But the medical knowledge, proximity, and, you know, this theory is possible, but it doesn't hold any weight to me. Like, I can't say for certain that this is true. And again, yeah. Once I read the book, I will absolutely have Kadra on for a bonus follow-up because I'm curious.
Sure.
My listeners, if anybody has read it, please let me know if I have not included anything damning in there and I'm just wasting my time.
That yeah, well, and I think you said you're focusing on, like, really popular theories, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, this is such a huge story, so... True crime enthusiasts that are listening, you've probably heard some smaller theories too that we might not even discuss. So
correct.
Let us know.
Yeah, I don't know. I have a favorite theory, but I don't know if it holds any more weight than any of the ones that we have right now. So
okay.
I'm curious. The yeah. next suspect is also a George named George Knowlton. George's daughter, Janice Knowlton, writes in her own book that she saw her father, George, beat Elizabeth to death with a hammer that he forced her, and that he forced her to accompany him to dispose of the body. And she was just 10 years old at the time. Now, this to me feels less reliable because Janice claimed that Elizabeth was working as a sex worker and was living in a room made in their garage at the time, and that she had been having an affair with her father. Elizabeth had never worked in sex work, according to those who knew her, and when they searched the home where this murder had allegedly taken place, no evidence was ever found. Janice Knowlton died of an overdose. Wow, I should just not trust Google correct. Janice Knowlton died of an overdose of prescription drugs deemed to be a suicide in March of 2004. Now, these memories of Janice's started to come out in therapy after she had suffered some pretty severe PTSD and had undergone hypnosis. So that's where a lot of these memories came from. And I don't know how legitimate that could have been after the fact, you know?
Yeah. Well, I literally just covered a case that where hypnosis comes up. And a lot of psychology experts scrutinize hypnosis because you have to be very, very specially trained to do it. And there can be leading questions and you don't know if those memories are actually true or confabulatory. And
I have heard of this theory. This does ring a bell. The last time I heard the Black Dahlia case covered by it was some other podcast, but yeah, I mean, what always gets me about
things like
this.
Could be a true memory of hers, but maybe it wasn't Elizabeth Short. Maybe it was somebody else that was fair and had dark black hair, and because her face had been in the media so much, her brain wanted to believe that that's who it was. Like,
yeah. And people do like falsely confess, for example, all the time. But what always gets me about things like this is like, why would you make something like that up? I don't know. Wow. That's very scary.
Yeah.
It's a head scratcher.
I love that Kadra's taking notes over here. She's got her own little bulletin board happening with red string.
Yeah, anytime multiple names are coming up, I tend to write them down because I'm not going to remember the names.
No, I totally get it. But so many people pointed to her possible suicide as being like related to guilt of like having participated in this as a child as well. But who knows? Maybe she was just deeply traumatized from whatever else had occurred in her life. Like, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. And it didn't necessarily mean that she had completed suicide. People accidentally overdose on prescription drugs that aren't supposed to be taken together, like Heath Ledger, for example. You don't know that it was a suicide. Like,
yeah, I don't buy that at all. Because if she was 10 years old at that time, that means this was all, you said 2004? Is when
that she had died. Yeah.
I mean, that's like 60 years later? I don't buy that at all.
No.
Yeah.
The 1951 suspect list by the LAPD lieutenant named James B. Jamison included a man named Dr. Patrick Shane O'Reilly. He was an orthopedic surgeon in Los Angeles during the 1940s. He was considered a suspect because of his association with two of Elizabeth Short's friends, including Mark Hansen, and having physically assaulted his secretary in 1939.
The one that he was making jokes or something about killing, allegedly?
Oh, no, not.
Oh, that was the other guy.
That
Sorry,
was
I
George
can't
Total.
Keep the. Yeah. See, this is why I write names down. I can't keep the stuff straight.
But
okay.
According to this assault against his secretary in 1939, he surgically removed part of her right breast, similarly to the mutation that had been done to Elizabeth Short's body. But nothing was ever proven.
I mean, that's the best thing I've heard so far, though, like as far as theories go. And not that, you know what I mean? That's not a great thing by any means. That's horrific.
No. But like the mutilation, the attack, it shows anger. It shows a tendency towards violence. He's in the same circle as her.
Yeah, exactly. Oh,
and he has medical knowledge.
Can we back up for a second? He surgically removed a woman's breast.
His secretary, when he attacked her, he like cut her breast.
And this man is just like walking around?
I think he did serve time for that assault, but I didn't dig too far into it other than the fact that that had occurred. Like,
I mean, that's very clear that he is like a sadistic, sexually motivated individual.
Correct.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Patrick Shane O'Reilly. Okay.
Patrick Shane O'Reilly. He was on the suspect list that was released by one of the top lieutenants after he retired. So I'm curious to know what had come about of that.
Yeah, like I want to know how they investigated him.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, like the way that the investigation had gone thus far, like I don't know how these interviews were being done. I don't know how thorough they actually were in looking into these people. But this is the most damning one to me right now.
Yeah, by far.
Because this is like, it shows proof that he could have potentially known her being in the same circle.
Yeah, I mean, statistics alone, what are the chances, number one, that you get murdered? And number two, that you have a man in your circle who has
with medical knowledge that attacks women.
Yeah, and very specific and similar to how she was attacked. I'm sorry, like the chances are very slim.
Yeah.
Wow.
But taking that little pin out of your Zodiac comment, this was the rabbit hole that I went on while you were waiting for me.
Okay, yes. We had to start our recording a little late because Alicia was like, hold on, Kadra, I just went down
this
rabbit hole.
Because I wrote these notes a little while ago, and I always like to double check. Like, maybe something catastrophic has occurred in the last month where this has been solved. So I wanted to look and see, you know, what else had happened. And I saw an article from December of 2025. Where an internet sleuth named Alex Babner believes that the Zodiac Killer and the killer of Elizabeth Short are the same person.
Okay. They both.
Vallejo, California. Just saying. Both in the same area.
Okay.
According to Alex Babner, he believes that Marvin Margolis is the Zodiac Killer and the killer of Elizabeth Short. He was a pre-med student and a World War II corpsman, so he would have had medical knowledge and experience handling bodies. He lived under a number of aliases and was questioned by police but was never charged. He had initially lied about knowing Elizabeth, but apparently they had had lived together during a short time before her death, according to mail records.
They lived together?
Yeah.
Weird. Okay, and we don't know if they had any kind of romantic relationship?
No. My guess
But in this time period, I don't know why else, you know? I mean, I don't know the age difference between these people, but...
Yeah, okay. Seems strange for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be very, very taboo back then.
You know,
then.
She did have a lot of male friends as well. They could have just been friends and roommates. Who knows?
I don't know. I feel like, I mean, it could have been different, but like, this is before the hippie movement. This is the 40s. Okay.
It's That's weird for sure. And she had, like, she has had a history of living with other men. Like, there was the army sergeant that abused her. Like, she had lived with men in the past. So that's not crazy.
And there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. I'm just thinking that I'm thinking romance could have been a factor there. I don't know.
I feel like this had to have been a crime. Like, who could do this to a person unless you're an absolute sadist? Like,
right. Yeah. Are you saying you think it could have been like a crime of passion? Like, someone who had
a crime of passion.
Connection to her? Yeah.
And then if the person had medical knowledge and was sadistically curious, maybe that's why he cut her in half. Maybe he was trying to hide evidence of sexual assaults, and that's he wanted to put on a show as his final, like, look what I did. I don't know. Maybe it was some sort of message to other women, like, if you're going to behave like she rumoredly did, that this could be what happened to you. Like, I don't know. It's disgusting either way. But allegedly they lived together, according to mail records. Now, according to Alex Babner, the 1970s Zodiac note that was sent to the Chronicle says, "My name is blank," with a series of symbols and letters. The hidden code, according to him, apparently states that his name is Marvin Merrill, which is one of the names that Marvin Margolis was using shortly after Elizabeth Short was murdered. Supporters of Alex Babner point to Marvin's medical training as a Navy corpsman, his documented psychological instability after he had been in combat, and his disturbing sketch that he drew in 1992, shortly before his death. The drawing depicts a mutilated woman labeled Elizabeth, with the word Zodiac allegedly hidden in the shading.
Whoa. That's interesting, too, because I just so happened to write down the year that that book was published about the other theory with Steve Hodell, the Hodells, and the that's the same year that that book came out.
Yeah. Crazy. And
so it was a picture he drew of her?
It's of a woman who was grotesquely mutilated, and it says Elizabeth underneath.
I wonder if the woman looked similar to her.
And I've never seen the photo, and I did try and find it. I'm guessing it's somewhere in evidence, but
But it said Zodiac?
And it says Zodiac allegedly hidden in shading under the photo. Like, shading in the photo, apparently.
Wow. It looks like I want to see this picture.
I do too.
Confused now, because I was so like, there's no way it's not Patrick, but now I'm really confused.
I know. This is why it's fun to talk about.
Because the fact that, like, the Marvin Merrill name is another name he was using, I mean, what are the chances? That's a very distinct name, you know? And he was in the same area. Zodiac was operating in the same area.
Yeah, just later. But it seems strange to me. Like, yes, I mean, the two crimes happen so close to each other, and it is very possible. But I don't know how somebody goes from horrifically carving a young woman Which, I mean, he did allegedly live with her, so maybe that was the crime of passion. Maybe that was, you know, a separate crime to the Zodiac crimes. Because, as we know, the Zodiac killer killed people on Lover's Lane. If he was so distraught by this, you know, lovelorn not working out, he killed Elizabeth Smart and then went on to be an angry middle-aged man to kill people in love. Maybe.
Well, and I mean, this was a highly publicized case. So the other thing I'm wondering is if the Zodiac took some inspiration from Black Dahlia and it was a different guy.
Yeah, for sure. It very well could be. And I mean, we know that Arthur Lee Allen has been listed as the prime suspect of the Zodiac killer. But again, we don't know for sure. But according to Rick Jackson, a former LAPD officer, he believes that Alex Babner's theory holds some weight. He says that there are too many links between the two and there's an overwhelming amount of circumstantial evidence that he left behind. End quote. So I think that this is something that they're going to now be looking into and that we might see future updates on. Who knows? Or maybe, I mean, I know Alex Babner said that he used AI to help solve the crypto, like the letters and symbols that were written by the Zodiac. But I mean, like how many, like, it's just such a specific name, like you said. So
I don't love that. I don't love either. That is how he figured that out. I'm very anti-AI. But
I am too.
Okay.
So, but just something to note. I'm here to present all the information.
I mean, well, and there's experts saying the theory holds weight. So I'm not going to discount it. It's definitely something that I will be
looking
into more.
And I need to see
more.
This drawing that he did.
Absolutely. Yeah. Man, this is making me wish, because Alicia's going to be on my show soon. This is making me wish I would have looked at Zodiac. And then, like, we could have talked about that.
That would have been a fun little crossover. But again, I just discovered this tidbit this morning. So
yeah, damn.
But maybe, okay, we have to do the Zodiac together now.
Okay.
Gotta happen. One of us
I have been wanting to cover the Zodiac for a long time. So yeah, no, that would be very good to cover together.
Much like the Black Dahlia case, the Zodiac case has been a Roman Empire of mine since I was like 16 years old.
Totally.
It's haunting. I don't know. Cases where like they're writing the police and it's like old timey vibes. I'm just fascinated with. I don't know why.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's something even more
fascinating about mystery. Yeah.
Yeah. Older true crime cases. There's something even more fascinating about it because like you said earlier, they had such limited resources. Mm-hmm. And it always seems like in those cases specifically, there were so many horrible, horrible people living in one area at the same time. Like, I don't know. It always seems like in those
sometimes.
Yeah. What are the chances all these horrible people live in one area?
But that is the Elizabeth Short case as it stands today. We don't know who her true killer is or if that person is still alive at this point. It feels unlikely to me that they're still alive, but I know that this story has haunted me from a young age and that something this horrific and sensationalized could possibly go unsolved. She deserved so much better from the world, from the LAPD, from every situation here, because to me, this case felt solvable and there were so many missteps along the way. But those are the most plausible theories and people, in my opinion, from what I saw on the internet, even though some of them are very loose, some of them are very strong that make us question really who could have possibly done it. But Elizabeth is buried in the Mountain View Cemetery in Oakville, California. Apparently she gets many visitors and offerings at her gravesite. And I do really hope that this new technology that we have today will one day help us get her case solved. So now I'm curious, my love, what are your favorite theories? What are your final thoughts here?
Yeah, I mean, in cases like this, you have to go through, as Jules said on my show recently, the spinny wheel of theories where it's like you're throwing everything out there. But by far, the things that have the most weight to me, I would say the Zodiac theory and then also Patrick Shane O'Reilly, because he had that personal connection and we know that he assaulted a woman in a very similar fashion.
And that he had medical knowledge.
Yeah. I mean, if you want my personal opinion, I'm still looking at him the most just because he knew her personally.
Me too.
And I mean, the Zodiac used many names. I'm wondering if maybe this Patrick guy could have, who knows, maybe he could have been the Zodiac. I don't know. But I do, one thing I want to come back to. So her, allegedly hers, her shoe and her purse were found. Have those, do they still have those? Have those items been lost? Have they ever been tested?
As far as I know, they're still in evidence, but they were tested. And that's how they know that they were cleaned, because they weren't able to pull anything from it.
Okay, I'm just wondering, like, more modernly, if they had been able to get any kind of, like, DNA off of them, you know? Because the resources back then, forensically, would have been very different than have now.
Yeah. I agree. As far as I know, nothing has been tested that they have had from back then today.
Or the letters, all the letters they got.
But I feel like they need to.
That's possible. I mean, there's things that sit in evidence lockers or sealed envelopes for decades and decades and don't get tested because they, quote unquote, don't have the resources.
Yeah. And I think that because of how much time has passed in this case, I think that the LAPD are forced to look at newer cases now and aren't giving the resources to the Black Dahlia case.
Yeah.
But her case record is still stated as open. So.
Okay. Yeah. So do you know if it's them who have the evidence still in possession? Because sometimes it gets handed over to, like, the DOJ or someone else.
Mm-hmm. As far as reported, yes, they do still have it. So. And they,
well,
and
we
they
can only hope.
They do, like, there's an active case number for her. Somebody could still submit a tip if they wanted to, but.
Wow.
I just,
well,
don't
like
know.
You said, it's highly I mean, this guy would be extremely old at this point. There's no way the killer's alive. I mean, statistically, they would have been at least in their 20s, and it was in 47, right, that this happened. So, yeah, the guy's long dead. It'd have to be a distant relative or a descendant or somebody that would come forward. But
yeah, which is what makes happen. All these books of people claiming that their parents did it really interesting, but. It also makes me sad because I don't want her case to be unsolved. Like, I want it to be solved, but.
Yeah, no, and it, like you said, it does. Hard. Well, but like you said, it does feel solvable. And it's one of those cases where if things would have been in the investigation handled better, then we might have a different outcome.
I wish, like, honestly. It's so infamous. There's so many theories on the internet. Like, maybe somebody out there, like Alex Babner, does have the right theory that we just, I don't know, need to take seriously. I hope
absolutely.
That they look deeper into that, though, because I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those cases you could have an entire podcast just about the Black Dahlia. But I mean, I'm curious to know your listeners' thoughts for sure. And I really appreciate you telling this to me because it's been a really long time since I have, like, heard someone cover it. So there were a lot of details I had forgotten about, and especially discussing it, you're going to take away a lot more. And what a absolutely disgusting, horrific thing that happened to this poor woman. And I mean, there's just so many things throughout her life where it's like she was doing everything on her own, and she was figuring it out, and she was 22 years old. I mean, that you should never have to worry about that happening to you. And it's unfortunate the way that the media handled this case, and her, I feel really bad for her mother as well.
Yeah, her mom did, as far as I know, move to California shortly after her daughter's murder to be close to her grave, which I think is really sweet.
That is, yeah.
Like, you know, we talk about victims as being victims, but, like, their family members are victims as well. They're, like, the layers of pain behind the story are so vast. And I think that it's really important to tell stories in a tasteful way that 1947 LA was not doing. And even in some cases today aren't handled appropriately. And it makes me sad. And this case is so daunting because people are so obsessed with it. So I hope that I did it justice for my listeners.
No, I always appreciate how you cover these cases. I think focusing on the facts and the victim is the most important thing. And as someone who is a close friend of yours and has followed you a long time, Alicia sent me her very first episode of Truly Twisted before she released everything. And as soon as I listened to it, I was like, you have something here. Keep going. This is going to be really good. And I just think you are absolutely doing such good work over here. And keep showing Alicia love, you guys. She works. I know you guys don't see what happens behind the scenes and you might not care, but like she works so, so hard. And yeah, I just love and respect you so much and think you're doing a wonderful job. And I'm happy to have been on here. I've been on her other show before, but I'm really happy to be on Truly Twisted.
It's been a long time coming. I know. I'm excited.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this was great. Thank you so much for sharing this story with me.
Thank you for coming on to discuss theories, because I think that it's way more fun in cases like this to have a guest with you to talk about it with, because I think that there's enough separation in the time that it happened that you can bounce some theories around. And who knows, maybe a conversation like this will solve it one day.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's been what, like 80 years?
Almost 80 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
That's insane. But thank you, Kadra. Go show Kadra some love as well. And a fun announcement to our listeners that we will be in CrimeCon in May together if anyone happens to also be going to CrimeCon and wants to meet up with us. So,
yes, it's going to be so much fun. I'm so excited. We just booked our hotel. Me and Alicia are going to be roomies bouncing around Vegas, making a scene. You know us. It'll be fun. Yeah, I'm
so
really
excited
about that. And like I said, Alicia's going to be on my show soon, and I'm just going to tell you guys now, we are going to talk about David Koresh and the Waco siege. I live in Texas, really close to Waco, and yeah, we are going to be getting into that soon. So Alicia, I don't know when you're dropping this, but it'll come out at the end of January.
This comes out on Thursday.
Okay, yeah, so... End of January, me and Alicia are going to be talking about the Waco siege, the Branch Davidians, and David Koresh, if you guys are interested in that.
Yeah. I'll be sure to mention it closer to that release to remind everybody, but definitely go and follow Kadra and show her some love. She releases new episodes on Wednesday.
Yes, ma'am.
I can't say that I've listened on a Wednesday in a long time, but I do listen every week.
I feel that.
I just want to say thank you so much for listening this week, everybody. I will be back next Thursday with another episode for you. And in the meantime, remember, you are wanted, you are loved, and you deserve to be here. And I will see you next week. Bye.
Bye, everybody. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode today, this special recording with Alicia from Truly Twisted. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, let me know, continue to follow along, and be sure to check out Truly Twisted wherever you get your podcasts. We will be back to our regularly scheduled programming next week. You all are amazing. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, and I will talk to you next week. Bye.